Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. We're revisiting our series, The Political Editors, which is one of the favourite things that I did on the podcast this year. In this episode two, it's a really special chat with Julian Haviland, who joined The Times as political editor from ITN in 1981.
I don't think that other people in the world would share the view that there is mounting chaos.
Where there is discord, may we bring harmony.
We're all right!
It is time to put up or shut up.
A new dawn has broken, has it not?
This is a decisive moment for the world economy.
Now the decision has been made to leave, we need to find the best way.
Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed.
I have been repeatedly assured that there was no party.
Growth and growth.
Some mistakes were made.
Half a century of politics told by the people who wrote the first draft of history for The Times. This is The Political Editors. For this episode, Julian Haviland on making the journey from political editor of ITN to The Times, his memories of Thatcher, Wilson, Alec Douglas-Hume, and a remarkable story about the Queen he never got to publish.
The Queen was watching this on telly, and when the horses went in and rode through some of the miners and knocked through the arm, the Queen said words to them, "Oh, that's awful." She took an extremely large scotch. Her husband, Dennis, was the one who said a drink like a drain. But Margaret had quite a capacity.
Now, this is a particularly special episode of The Political Editors because Julian Haviland died earlier this month, exactly a month after our interview. His career spanned a remarkable period of British history, and he was known for his exacting journalistic standards, his persistence and impartiality, but also for his affable and courteous manner, as you'll hear during the course of our interview. He started out in journalism at the Surrey Advertiser before moving to South Africa and reporting for the Johannesburg Star. Returning to London, he began his television career at ITN, first as a reporter, and then eventually, in 1975, he became ITN's political editor. He met every Prime Minister from Alec Douglas-Hume onwards. But let's start with his thoughts on Harold Wilson, who first led Labour to a narrow election victory in 1964.
Harold Wilson was a lovely man. Tories thought he was damn clever, but nasty.
We've got a job to do. We can only do that job as one people, and I'm going right in to start that job now.
The truth is the opposite. He often made quite serious mistakes. As a human being, he's very warm and pleasant, and he once lent his house in the Scillies to Ray Gunter, who'd been one of the Transport Union representatives. And Ray disappeared. He had cancer. They spent several weeks. We now see what happened to him. And one day, there he was back in the lobbies and spitting blood, almost literally. I said, "Ray, what's up with you?" He said, do you know what the little senator's done to me? That little senator, Wilson, who we hated, And he said, I said, no, of course I mean. He went, he's lent me his cottage in the Scillies to get better, and has made a remarkable difference in my recovery. But, and Ray was very upset because Wilson has shot his own fox, as it were, and so he could no longer go around saying what a swine the man was. And he came back to me after a few seconds and said, by the way, the little so-and-so says, I mustn't tell anybody, so keep it to yourself. So I thought Wilson came rather well out of that. I didn't think he was all that good a prime minister. He had his flaws. But as a human being, he could be quite delightful, and he was generous. I think not being Alec Hume helped, because he seemed more like an ordinary bloke. But he's quite clever at getting headlines too, and he had a good staff around him who helped him.
There was Julian Haviland's view of Howard Wilson, seemingly a decent and warm man who made some poor political decisions. Well, it was certainly a far more favourable impression than that made by Ted Heath, who defeated Wilson to enter Downing Street in 1970.
He was as dour as everybody would think.
I never discuss personal matters, actually, with my colleagues. I never have done.
He didn't often crack a joke. At least we did. It wasn't particularly funny. And he was not easily accessible to any except a few lobby correspondents. So I didn't think I can characterize him. He was a dull man, essentially. He did terribly well in life and in politics. But he had very few friends. Well, sadly, he was lonely. He was a bit solitary.
Julian Hammond's view of the solitary Ted Heath. Well, Julian also had a tricky relationship with James Callaghan. Before entering Number 10, Callaghan was Howard Wilson's chancellor, but he resigned after being forced to devalue the pound. Wilson immediately brought him back as Home Secretary.
Speaking for myself, I think there's a lot to be said for the pound. Every one of us in Britain's familiar with it. We know what it stands for. Abroad, they know what it stands for. And it's as good a system as any other system you could find. So the pound and the penny, two old coins and units, they hold the day.
Callaghan and I didn't much get on. It didn't matter. Things got better after a bit. But when he had resigned at the time of the devaluation, as Chancellor and became Home Secretary, he came to the ITN studios and he was so smug about it. He said, well, it was my duty to resign because I was Chancellor after all, and I thought it was time that someone took my place. And he was so smug, I couldn't help saying, well, you didn't do so badly, did you, because you jumped out of the Treasury and you're now Home Secretary. It came out ruder than I normally like to be, and he would have struck me if we hadn't been live on So we're never good friends, but I did admire him.
Julian Haviland recalling Jim Callaghan's decision to resign as Chancellor and explain the two didn't get on to to the point that he thought that Jim Callaghan might have punched him. Well, Julian Haviland was known well to the nation as ITN's political editor and trusted by politicians of all parties. He impressed by his reputation at Westminster, the editor of the Times, Harold Evans, persuaded him to make the unusual move from broadcast to print journalism in 1981 to become the political editor of the Times. Julian describes what happened in his typically crisp and succinct style.
I've done quite a lot of time with ITN. I was enjoying myself, but I got a call out of the blue from Harry Evans, the Times editor then, whom I'd always greatly admired. And you don't turn down the offer of editorship of the Times or political editorship. So I didn't.
Yeah, you definitely don't turn down the offer of a job as political editor of the Times. And Julian threw himself into reporting on the difficult early days of the Thatcher government, regularly taking calls from senior ministers without having to ring them himself. But he didn't find the move into print journalism entirely straightforward. He was used to summing up stories in a few hundred words for a TV broadcast and now had to write stories that could be longer than 1,000 words.
The lead column of the Times, you had the lead with two columns, perhaps 1,500 words. There's the lead story on television would be 500-600 words if we were lucky. The great thing is they couldn't cut you off on telly. Once you promised to go from 500 words or no more, you were free to go and go and go and drive everyone nuts. But on Times, it was Buzzball sub-editor, still is, I'm sure, who had the last word. When I went to the Times, Ian Aitken, who I mentioned, was lovely. And I said, I'm not going to know how to film. He says, it did easy, Drew. Never use one word where 17 will do. It was a good rule, so I used to do 17 words in one.
Yeah, I'm sure the sub-editors loved you. Which do you prefer? Did you prefer working in TV or in print?
TV was easier because you were always, deadlines weren't so pressing. I was shocked by how soon, if you were going to make the front page, you had to have your copy on the Times. Whereas without you, with the main news, as it always was, you could walk in at the last moment and spout. And as I say, never could stop. And so it was easier. And you thought the poor newspaper people are going to have to catch up because the events I'm describing, they'd have had to write about at 7 o'clock. And here am I with an update at 2:50. So telly was much easier.
Julian, they're summing up the differences between broadcast and print journalism. Although I have to say, I don't think I've ever been told at the Times, never use one word when 17 will do. They'll definitely cut that out. You're listening to episode 2 of The Political Editors with Julian Haviland. In a moment, we'll hear about his first interview with Margaret Thatcher after joining the paper, and a remarkable story that hasn't been heard before about the late Queen's reaction to the Battle of Orgreave, a story that at the time he wasn't able to publish.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Let's return then to my interview with Julian Haviland, who was the political editor of the Times from 1981 to 1986. Now, Julian spent the bulk of his career at Westminster from the 1960s until his retirement in the 1980s. I asked him which politicians he remembered as the most powerful speakers in the Commons.
I remember the ones who were genuinely eloquent, and so they had the potential of changing the other side's mind. Tony Benn was a very remarkable speaker.
We've tried to make capitalism work with good and humane Labour governments, and we haven't succeeded because it can't work, because it rests on injustice.
Brian Walden later became a television presenter. Those three stand. Oh, I had the most eloquent of all, a man called John P. McIntosh, who was Labour MP for the marginal seat of Berwick, and didn't last long because it was a very marginal seat. But he could hold any audience in his hand. And they're not people who made high office, but they're very, very competent speakers and good people. I remember them. I mean, the press gallery upstairs was empty. If the name Ben came up on the annunciator, as we then called it, anchor from more subtle than they were internal television. And everyone rushed down to the chamber to hear these people speaking. There weren't many of those.
Really interesting how the names Tony Benn, Brian Walden, John P. McIntosh were the MPs that would send journalists scurrying to the gallery to listen to them. Well, some of his favourite politicians, like any journalists, were the talkative ones. But sometimes they told him things he was unable to publish. This is Julian describing what happened when Cecil Parkinson, Margaret Thatcher's trade and industry secretary, told him a story during the Falklands War, which Julian worried would put lives at risk.
I like the blabby ones because they're so useful. And I sort out the discreet politicians. Sometimes they sort me out because they were kind of people who liked getting publicity. A very good example was Cecil Parkinson. At the time of the Falklands War, Margaret Thatcher had an inner cabinet, as you'd expect, of Foreign Secretary, Defence Secretary, Chiefs of Staff, and Cecil Parkinson, who's relatively inexperienced, who's Secretary of State for Industry, I think. And she adds him too. He knew nothing about warfare. I mean, she liked him. She thought he was a handsome fellow, which I dare say he was. And there came a time when I encountered him in the lobby, and he always wanted to talk to me, had something to say. And at the meeting that morning of the war cabinet, they had discussed, they'd heard that one of the farmers in East Falkland had rigged up a skywave aerial by linking his transmitter to the top fence of his paddock. And they're sending back top-class information to the government about where the urges were, what strength they were in, and settle what was a good story, as it was. And we were all, this is a time when the fleet, you may not remember this, Matt, they were in the South Atlantic on their way to Falklands, but none of us knew where they were or when or where they'd land. We were still under pressure from editors like my then editor, George Owens, to write a story about this. We had nothing to say. You knew nothing about him. And he said, well, tell me this story. I thought, now, last I got a story. It was an hour before deadline. So I raced upstairs to the lobby room, Times lobby room, and before I got there, I suddenly realized I couldn't print it because the urges would certainly have spotted the man and he'd be dead within a week, short. So I ran down where Cecil had already found someone else, some white man, dead telegraph. And I broke the rule, which is that if you see a journalist talking in the lobby, you don't interrupt the conversation. If something confidential may be passing. And I collared them both and said, look, Cecil, if you were just telling Jim, I speak to her, what you told me 10 minutes ago, you mustn't tell him. And Jim looked puzzled. And then soon the penny dropped with Jim. It never did drop with Cecil. I said, if we print this story, by sentencing this man to death, it's a good story. It's a pity to let it go, but we have to drop it. You know, people always say, you a journalist will stop at nothing, totally unprincipled, we'll get any story out. This was an account, I think, of the fact that journalists aren't totally indiscreet. It was business that was being indiscreet, and we were being rather good.
Amazing story from Julian Hamilton explaining that when he was the political editor of the Times, he didn't publish a story about a farmer in the Falklands transmitting information on the location of the Argentine fleet for fear it would put the farmer's life in danger. And he had to try and stop the blabby, in his words, Cabinet Minister Cecil Parkinson from briefing other journalists on it. Well, senior journalists were always keen to speak to him as the political editor of ITN because they felt it allowed them to reach ordinary men and women. Margaret Thatcher was no different. Here is Julian interviewing her on the television in July 1980.
Prime Minister, I think people would expect me to ask you about unemployment. May I ask you first how much higher you think it'll go?
I don't know. I've never been a politician who forecast unemployment. I do fear it will go higher next month, and I fear it will stay high for quite a time, as it did on the last occasion when we had a sudden increase in unemployment. But I can't give you a maximum figure.
Well, a year later, Julian left ITN to join The Times as political editor, and he found he had to wait a little longer for an interview with the Prime Minister. Here's what happened.
And the time came when I last got an interview with her. I was told the Prime Minister would see me now, rather graciously. So I went along, saw her, and I hadn't seen her for a year, so he covered all the bases. And after she'd finished, she took an extremely large scotch. Her husband, Dennis, was the one who said a drink like a drain. But Margaret had quite a capacity. So when I got back, Charlie Douglas, whom the editor, who was interested, said, "How did it go?" And I think I must have shaken a little bit, I said, with the falsehoods of my questions, because after I finished, she had a very large whiskey indeed, and before I get my lips to mine, she was halfway through a second very large whiskey, so I must have made an impression. Charlie said, "You fooled, Julie. You've forgotten what day it is, haven't you?" And it was Tuesday evening at 5 o'clock or what. And her next engagement was a weekly audience for the Queen at 6 o'clock. And the one person in the world of whom Margaret Thatcher was frightened was the Queen. And that's why she downed a lot of whiskey. And I flattered myself that she was nervous about me. Not a bit of it.
The Queen takes an intense interest in every aspect of life in our country, and she brings to bear a formidable grasp of current issues and a tremendous breadth of experience. Her guidance and advice are always most acute, and as Prime Minister, I was privileged to benefit from both enormously.
Amazing. It wasn't nerves after all about it being interviewed by Julian that led Margaret Thatcher to have a couple of stiff drinks, but the prospect of her weekly audience with the Queen. And probably the most remarkable story that Julian told me also involves the late Queen. It goes back to 1984, when the Battle of Orgreave saw a violent confrontation between striking miners in South Yorkshire and thousands of police officers from around the country.
During the miners' strike, you remember the occasional real flashpoints, and there was a famous event at Orgreave Coking Depot near Rotherham. Thatcher was determined to break the strike, and they got in as many as 8,000 pickets collected by Arthur Scargill to stop the lorries going in and out of the depot with the coke. And 5,000 policemen from all over the country, and a goodly number of mounted police who had nothing whatever to do with Rotherham, or Austin, as it were. And the Queen was watching this on telly, and when the horses went in and rode through some of the miners and knocked through down, the Queen said words to them, "Oh, that's awful. Oh, shit. We shouldn't do that." And the Queen, at the height of the vexed strike, to make a political comment like that, was news. And Charlie Douglas Hume, my editor then, who had the most astonishing contacts, being related to the heir to the throne and being a Douglas Hume, told me one afternoon that he'd heard the Queen at the dinner party the previous night said this. Julian said, "It's a good story, isn't it?" I said, "Yes. You will stand it up for me and write it by 6. And I said, "I think if you know the facts, you should write it yourself as a special correspondent or something." "No, I can't do that." I said, "You do it." I said, "Well, I'll come to the list. May not be that easy." And the rest of the day I spent trying to find out. And it turned out there were only 2 other people in the room when she said it. She had said it, and I felt absolutely firm. So I went back to Charlie. One was the Queen's private secretary, Robert Fellowes, and the other was George Younger, Secretary of State for Scotland, who I knew to be a friend of Charlie anyway. And anyway, I threw the story up beyond doubt, and I went back to her and said, "You perhaps ought to know before we go any further with this, so only 2 people heard that." "Okay," she said, "we'll drop it." I spent 6 hours sweating. I felt terribly pleased to have stood it up. It wasn't used.
absolutely extraordinary. Julian Haviland telling about the story he couldn't publish. The Queen expressing a disapproval of the police action at Orgreave at the height of the miners' strike. But because there were only two people at the dinner, one of them a cabinet minister, one of them a private secretary to the Queen, if the story had been published, it would have been obvious who it had come from. Well, Julian retired from daily journalism in 1986.
I just left because I'd had enough. I'd been around Westminster for 20 years, and I thought life must have something more to offer. And so it was.
And he really did. He and his family loved Scotland, where they lived, and he went on to produce two books, and as recently as last year, wrote again for the Times Red Box. Sadly, Julian Haviland died on August the 11th this year, not long after we recorded this interview, at the age of 93. It was a real privilege to be able to hear his reflections on being the political editor of ITN and The Times, and we felt very grateful that his family gave permission for us to air the interview, and I'm pleased to be able to bring them to you again. Coming up in the third episode of The Political Editors, we'll hear from Sir Peter Riddle, who in the late 80s and early 90s oversaw the dramatic decline of Margaret Thatcher and the period of underestimating John Major. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.